When we chose the theme of food as the theme of this winter learning seminar, it seemed at the time like a great idea because there's almost nothing in Jewish life that food doesn't touch on. And so the theme of food allows me to talk about all sorts of things. And then I began thinking about this shir p'ticha, this opening shiur, and I was overwhelmed with the things I could talk about. And I was like, this is a terrible theme because it gives me no guidance as to what we should actually talk about as our way in, because there's so many possible things we can talk about with food. And so what I want to do with you tonight is look at two texts and some ways of thinking that come out of those two texts. There's not a unifying theme to the learning tonight, but rather I want to sort of use these texts as ways to start a vorspeise, a kind of appetizer of the learning we're doing together this week. That's the idea here, is to sort of spark some thinking, sort of whet your appetites, no pun intended, for the different kinds of things we'll be talking about as the week progresses. And we're going to start with a text from the Torah, from Sefer Shmos, from the book of Exodus, a text that is a very strange text. And because it comes at the end of a parsha, we often miss the things that happen at the ends of parshas, right? We're like, usually the sort of most interesting stories happen in the beginnings of parshas, and then by the time we get to the Sefer Leah, we're a little tired, maybe we're not paying as much attention, and we often miss the stuff that at the end of the parsha. So this comes from Parshas Mishpatim. The previous week's parsha, Parshas Yisro, we get the sort of official, like, revelation at Sinai, right? That's the moment when God reveals God's self to the Jewish people, the Ten Commandments. It's the moment in Shul we stand for, because it's sort of the moment that we think of as the giving of the Torah. And then the next week, Parshas Mishpatim, we get into a lot of details, right? We begin with God's revelation, the Ten Commandments, and then God starts talking about all the details of, you know, well, here's what my Torah actually looks like in the very nitty-gritty sense of it. But then, after all this detail, which we shouldn't denigrate, to the contrary, that detail is amazing, after all that detail, we get to a weird, this word is overused, but I think it's the right word here, this weird mystical moment where Moshe and other leaders of the people go up the mountain, and there is this strange seeing of God, and Moses spills blood on the people as this kind of marker of the covenant. It's a very intense scene. And at the end of this, we get the following two psukim. Vayiru es Elokei Yisrael, they saw the God of Israel. Sachas raglav kemaseh livnas hasapir, and beneath God's feet, it was like the pavement of sapphire, some kind of gorgeous blue image. Like the very sky for purity. If you don't know what those English words mean, you're in good company, because we don't really know what those Hebrew words mean either. All right, but some kind of mystical image of actually God and God's throne, as it were. And God did not raise a hand against the leaders of the Israelites, which is a bit of a strange thing, right? Why do we have a sense that God would have raised a hand against these people? V'yechazu es Elohim, and they saw God, v'yochlu v'yishtu, and they ate and drank. So at the end of this sort of mystical experience, where they literally do this thing that later Jewish theologians will tell you you're not supposed to do, right? We're not supposed to be, if Maimonides, the Rambam, were in the room, he'd be like, whoa, well, that's not what it means, right? It doesn't, you're not allowed to see God. God doesn't have a body that you could see. But we take the verses at face value, they're having the most intimate experience of God's presence. Literally, it says seeing God. The verses say twice, right? They see God. And then what do? They eat and they drink. So eating and drinking stands at the pinnacle of this mystical experience. So let me turn over to you. What do you want to pull out from these verses? When you see these verses of this intense vision of God and concluding with eating and drinking, something that you think is interesting, something that you love, something that bothers you, a question you have.
This phrase, shalach yado, have an inherently negative or harmful connotation?
I think so. Some of the commentators here talk about, you might have thought that because they're seeing something they shouldn't be seeing, maybe God would have, right? It's not totally clear what that lo shalach yado is, but you might have thought maybe, you know, this is too close, maybe God would have found this too intimate and pushed them away, but God does not.
I'm surprised that they're eating and drinking as a response to seeing God and not being terrified or in awe. It seems like first it's describing such an amazing, like you said, mystical, not normal experience, and the response is to do something very festive, but something that we do, you know, kind of as part of the mundane.
Okay, great. So we go from the most spiritual, mystical experience to something that feels incredibly physical and earthy. Great. Anyone want to respond either by supporting what Noga has said or by challenging it? And when we challenge lovingly.
But I feel like maybe that's part of the point, which is that we like to think of like eating and drinking as like grounded tasks. And actually, like maybe the fact that this is an appropriate response to seeing God says something about the way that we eat and drink.
Okay, great. So Sam says maybe this is an overturning of what you would have expected. You would have thought, like Noga says, that's mundane. And the whole point is actually there's something mystical and spiritual about this.
Yeah, so I had two different thoughts on that. One, just like you said, like eating and drinking is like something you do to celebrate and in like a moment of simcha. And so like in like a very plain sense, I think that kind of makes sense. And another thing, kind of like we were talking about earlier with like both food and Torah being like life giving, I think you could interpret this in maybe a more metaphorical way of saying like to behold God is the same thing as to be eating and drinking. Like the way you could say like I like drank from the fountain of Torah or something in like a more poetic sense, like that like they were eating and drinking in this moment of
great. What do we do when we want to celebrate something? We make a l'chaim, right? We raise a glass. And so maybe that's what's going on here, right? It's a celebration of this incredible moment. And I'm not sure if the two things you're saying you mean to go together or you mean as sort of alternate possibilities, but the other possibility Miriam puts out there is, no, maybe it's actually the eating and drinking is not literally eating and drinking, but sort of drinking in God's presence. We'll see all of these in stories that come out of this in a little bit.
Yeah, because you started with the mystical thing, you go here, the Atzilei is like relevant to me of the world of Atzilut, that's like the highest level reaching out and respond to like, we think it's the most mundane eating and drinking, just kind of support what you both said before, like the contrast or not contrast, depending on how you view it. Even if it's not a contrast, it's a contrast, but we just made it not a contrast.
Excellent, thank you.
As the document of the Lafayette religious celebration, to me, the first thing I thought was like this is thinking out that we have like the hell to God. It's like the beginning.
Sorry, say that last sentence again. I just couldn't hear.
The hell to God. This is the beginning of the rest of their lives. And so now, like, life will never be the same. It's like the first day, the first moment of the whole rest of your life. What you do when you wake up and eat breakfast, so this to me was like the eating breakfast of like my life now that
I've been held with God. Great. I'm going to say one sentence which may or may not be what you said, and you'll tell me if I'm understanding you correctly based on this. Right? If I hear Leah Gittel correctly, and she'll correct me in a moment if I'm not, that there's a way in which almost the eating and drinking, it is mundane, but it's the start of the rest of your life as influenced by what you just experienced. Right? So like kind of the way Rav Aviv was just talking in her Dvar Torah, it marks the end of that experience, but the beginning of a new life that's enhanced by that experience. Did I capture that?
So there's confusion at like this divine encounter and then immediately eating drinking, I think some of the parallel, so the reverse for divine messengers coming to here's the focus with Abraham receiving the divine visitors, he immediately slaughters a calf, makes the cakes, and prepares a banquet for this sort of encounter between him and the divine. So they come to him versus Moses and the elders going up to
great. So spell out, so just make sure everyone heard that. So Rob saying, contrasting this with, I mean, maybe it wasn't contrasting, I'm not sure yet. We'll come back.
Some sort of synchronicity or mirroring going on between an encounter with the divine, in the case of Abraham, the divine messengers that came.
Great.
And this, but an encounter with the divine, and immediately followed by a sort of banquet.
And give us one more sentence about what that means then for this, right? If these are sort of mirror images, then you understand this passage to say...
Well, I guess maybe you can find an element of fellowship or sharing and intimacy that comes with banquets.
Excellent. Great. So food is a sign of intimacy and sort of in both directions, right? Coming back from this divine experience and having, in Avraham Avinu's case, in Abraham's case, this sort of moment of divine, semi-divine or divine visitors coming. Great.
Kind of wrapping up what Leah Gittel said, this kind of reminded me of a fast, more like specifically the Yom Kippur. You're at this point of like high divinity, and it always has to come to an end. And Yom Kippur will break the fast. It maybe doesn't have any special significance, but maybe it does.
Great. So we've heard a couple of things about this eating and drinking, right? We've got, it's surprising because it feels too earthy in light of such a spiritual experience. We've got, no, actually, it's contradicting that instinct to say, no, this too can be spiritual. We've got, no, it's a celebration. We've got, no, it's a marking of an end. And now Sam's sort of putting that last point even more sharply. It's like, no, like, it's not just at the beginning of the rest of your life, the way Leigh Gittel said it, but it's actually, yeah, and now we're done with the spiritual moment. How do we say that we're like stepping back from this experience with God? Well, when we daven, we take three steps back, right? When we actually in God's presence, maybe the way you mark that is by eating and drinking. And that's okay, I'm done now being in the direct presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Beautiful.
I agree with everything that's been said. I still want to play a pusher on this.
That it's surprising.
It's surprising. It just, especially, I mean, this is after the golden calf, right?
I mean, in the order of the Torah, it's before, but where it actually appears narratively is a little bit complicated.
Yeah, okay. So it seems like there are different responses that happen when other spiritually heavy moments happen. And it just seems to be so sudden that Loshalach Yado, and then Ve'zuratach Et Elohim Ve'achutish. It's like, it's so, it's not, and they did something, and after, like was just being said, after they have survived this experience or gone through this experience of being in touch with the divine, and then they celebrated, they ate and drank.
Right.
It seems to be very sudden.
The transition is so abrupt that's like the Torah wants you to be jarred by this, right? They saw God and they went out to the bar and had a drink, right? Lahavdil. Right? It's not exactly what we're going to see, but there's some version of that.
Yeah, they actually saw God, like they saw the image of God and God has feet, and God did not raise a hand, but maybe. Could have raised your hand, and I just think that when they ate and drank, they were also, like, it's not like then they left, then God left, and they ate and drank. It's like, then they ate and drank, so it's like maybe they were all eating together.
When you say they all, does they all include?
I've been saying it includes God.
Includes God. Great. There's no mark that God has departed here, so maybe the eating and drinking is including God in some sense. Yeah, Maya.
I think that they've just undergone this like, very intense experience, and therefore they might be weak and deprived of energy, and maybe it's telling us about something, like when you're in the presence of God and you see him, like it just wipes you out and you need to recharge, and they're doing this by eating and drinking.
Great. So maybe like you have to eat and drink because all of your physical energy has been used on this spiritual encounter, and you're drained from that.
Yeah, the abruptness of it, and also to this, and then you think, it's kind of like, we experience this, and we move on after, like, that was crazy. Now let's punish ourselves and, mark the end of this.
Yeah.
Of this experience that we had, I think the abruptness was also that you mentioned that because that was exactly what we needed. That it was a marker of the end of the transition.
Yeah, what I love about that is lahavdil, lahavdil, lahavdil. These are not the same, but. We're about to have, God willing, a week of very intense learning and community together. And sadly, it will come to an end on Thursday. And your instinct on Friday might be, I want to maintain the sort of kedusha that I've been living in for the last week, being in yeshiva, and I want to sort of have my Friday feel just as spiritual as my Thursday. That's a totally understandable response. And if I hear Leigh Gittel correctly, maybe another response might be, actually, I now just need to like go back to my normal life. Like, it was intense, it was great, but I need a day off from that kind of intensity, right? And that might also be an appropriate response. You know, again, we're not seeing God. Well, we'll see. But the intensity is unlikely to be this level of intensity, but still, you might feel like actually what I need is not to sort of continue the Kedusha into Friday, but actually have a more mundane Friday.
It seems also possible that we could read this last clause in the verse, as a sort of illustration of the first half of the verse, that is to say, we can imagine these Atzilei B'nei Yisrael, these leaders of the people of Israel, sitting, eating and drinking, and witnessing God. And the realization of the fact that God didn't strike them is the fact that they saw God and continued to eat and drink. That is to say, it is a mundane, festive activity. It's not the culmination of the spiritual experience, but it's a realization of the fact that they were able to continue being human in all of that mundanity, without being described down from God.
Beautiful.
There are other psukim not so far around from here where we talk about purity, washing clothing, and it could be that sort of along the lines of what someone was saying earlier, that like this is their first meal in Tahara. This is their first meal in purity. Mm. There was something about seeing Hashem and the Nas appear that was purifying.
Great.
Such that it changed their being.
Yeah, that feels like a very sort of like concrete way of sort of talking about what I think it was like Gettel was talking about, sort of this is the beginning of the rest of your life, right? For me, I feel that at the end of Yom Kippur, the first weekday Marav when Yom Kippur is over, we've been saying these extra insertions for 10 days. And if you're like, if you generally daven from memory and now you have these insertions, it literally for me feels like a burden on my shoulders all 10 days between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And I have these insertions that I have to remember. And then I get to that first Marav, and I've like gone through Yom Kippur and I feel spiritually cleansed if it goes well, which thank God sometimes it does. And that Marav feels light, right? And I think hear Max saying like this eating is like it's eating in a state of not necessarily literal ritual purity, although maybe you also mean that, but a kind of, you know, yeah, you just saw Tohar and now you're sort of experiencing living your life in Tohar. Beautiful.
So I think it's interesting, and it's possible to understand this too, but that they beheld God and they ate and drank are kind of phrased as equivalents. So it's kind of like what you were saying, that it seems like they're seen as like equal partners in the same goal of like praising God or something.
The equal partners being the seeing God and the eating.
Yeah.
They're both parts of the same thing.
Exactly.
Right? There's the verse is almost parallel. They saw God and they ate and drank. And maybe that itself, right? Maybe there's a difference between eating to fulfill your bodily needs and eating in a way that is actually a spiritual activity. For those of you familiar with the Hasidic practice of shirayim, right, of eating leftovers from the Rebbe, which can be perceived, and I think in some cases really is a sort of, you know, almost like, to my mind, excessive veneration of a human being, but there are people who will frame it as what really is happening when people eat the leftovers from the Rebbe is they're not sort of, it's not about venerating this person that you like just want to even have their leftovers, but rather someone who's gone to a point where they even eat in a state of spiritual consciousness, there's something that becomes special in that act of eating, right? And maybe sort of having that as part of what's going on here. Okay, let's see three sources that engage in many of the same ways that you guys have engaged with these set of verses. The earliest one from the Gemara, from Bavli Brachos, 17a. Maragla b'fumei darav, a pearl in Rav's mouth. Lo ka'olam hazeh olam haba. This world is nothing like the world to come. Ha'olam haba ein bo lo achila v'lo shasiya. In the world to come, there's no eating and there's no drinking, right? You might have imagined the Messianic era as a time when you'd get all the best foods, right? My kids learned in school that it's a time when candy will grow on trees. But in fact, this Gemara says that Mor Yehudas was wrong, and in that, in fact, it is a time when you won't eat or drink anything. Velo perio rivia, and not sexual reproduction. Velo masa umatan, and not business. Velo kina, no jealousy. Velo sina, and no hatred. Velo tacharus, no competition. Ele tzadikim yoshvin atrosehem bereshehem. Rather, the righteous sit with their crowns on their heads. V'nani meziv hashchina, and they benefit, they get sustenance from the light of the divine presence. How do we know this? Shenemar, vayachazu es Elohim, vayochlu v'yishtu. From our verse, they saw God and then they ate and drank. We learn that in the world to come, there will be no eating and drinking, right? Which is in some ways a totally radical rereading, not in some ways, it is a radical rereading of the verse. It means they didn't really eat and drink. What the Torah means when it tells us they ate and drank was they're eating and, I think it was Miriam who said this, right? They're actually eating and drinking from God's presence. That's the sustenance they're getting. Responses to the Gemara's reading of the verse. Other than Miriam who's just going to say, yeah, that's exactly right.
It's just like, they couldn't possibly be eating and drinking. So it must be that they were eating.
Great.
There's no possible world in which you could see God.
Couldn't be. Right. It's like, it starts with the problem of Noga and ends with the solution of Miriam. It's like, that can't be. You wouldn't eat and drink after seeing God. Ah, so it must mean they're eating and drinking God's light. They're learning Torah, essentially, right? We're eating and drinking right now, which we shouldn't tell the SHA because we're not allowed to eat and drink in here.
But I was thinking, like, the world to come, like, it doesn't have, like, kind of the best things about, like, this world, you know? Like, some of the best things and also some of the things that are maybe not the best things, but that make that like it's like the stuff of life, you know? And it makes me think like I'm not ready for the world to come, like to give
great.
The stuff of life.
Yeah. And this is a theme that we're going to come back to on Wednesday. Wednesday's learning is going to be focused on denial and delight, right? To what extent does the Torah want us to live a minimal life in the physical world and really be focused on the spiritual? And to what extent does the Torah actually say, no, part of your role is to be in the world? And Leah Gittel's saying, if the world to come has no food, no drink, no sex, no, I mean, we can do without jealousy and hatred. I think that's a good thing to get rid of. Right, but like, there's a lot of great stuff in this world that doesn't sound like it's going to be there. And by the way, I made fun of my kids' education before of learning that candy will grow on trees. That kind of idea also exists in classical rabbinic literature. So I don't want to suggest that that's wrong and this is what the world to come will look like. There are actually competing views in rabbinic literature of what the world to come will look like. But this is coming from a place of, yeah, like, to be a spiritual person, you minimize your eating and drinking. You're a Hasidic Rebbe, and you're really trying to control it. Okay, I've got...
Yeah, on this list of items, it's hard to tell exactly clearly eating and drinking whether it's considered good or bad, right? Because the things at the end we generally consider bad, so now hatred and competition. But so is everything on this list bad? There are other things that are good? Is there like some sort of progression or degression? Like that's what I'm...
Excellent. And so let me say out that question in a slightly different way. You'll tell me if I'm understanding you correctly. It's clear, I think it's clear, and Alicia thinks it's clear, that some of these things on this list are bad. It's unclear if the things that come at the beginning are bad or just incompatible with a fully spiritual life, right? They might be good, but not relevant in a world to come. Great.
Yeah, I think one way of thinking about this that helps me understand it is to take the Yom Kippur metaphor, not really metaphor, I guess, like, pretty literally, but to think about which fast is easier, to Tisha B'Av or Yom Kippur. And for me, it's definitely Yom Kippur.
No question.
I'm busying myself with bettering myself, thinking about God, versus Tisha B'Av, you're like, maybe watch like a sad movie and like do some program if you're in camp and like go to shul or whatever. And like, but then the second half of the day is like really, really slow. And then for me, Yom Kippur, the second half of the day is like extremely empowering. And then you reach Maariv and you're like, I'm not going to go to Maariv, I'm just going to go eat. And then you get there and you're like, I'm going to stay for Maariv because you've been sustained by the tefillah.
Beautiful, right? So some of us have actually experienced that sense of feeling sustained by the spirituality, right? And I actually don't notice on a good Yom Kippur, which not every Yom Kippur for me is, but on a good Yom Kippur, I am not hungry at Ne'ilah, right? I'm hungry at Mincha, but I'm not hungry at Ne'ilah, right? By that point, I'm like, no, there's a spiritual high that's coming here. It's, again, lahavdil, but not so much, right? I am actually nana, I'm actually benefiting and being sustained by the light of the divine presence. Noga.
Yeah, similarly to this question of are these things good, bad, are they just part of our current world and in a future world, would it be good to not have them, or be more spiritual not to have them? I have this question also about, it talks about all these things that all people do, and then it talks about, instead that tzaddikim will sit and have crowns on their head, and it brings me further juxtaposition this question of, the tzaddikim are receiving sustenance from the Shekhinah, and it's like, okay, is that replacing what the food is in Olam Hazeh? Is that how we receive sustenance from the Shekhinah? Are there some people who receive sustenance from jealousy, hatred, and competition? I think we can agree that there probably are some people like that. And whether these things are good or bad, there are different ways that we engage with meaning or finding purpose or interacting with the divine.
Great. It's like the famous Talmudic story in which they capture the Yetzer Hara, right? The evil inclination, and no production happens anymore because, like, once you're not driven by some sense of jealousy and competition, well, then maybe you might just sit back and not do anything.
So I can see your question about, like, are these all bad things? But I thought, kind of, like, these are things that are not necessarily bad, but, like, are products of, like, things that are bad in the world or things that are, like, perhaps broken in the world. So, like, one way of looking at it is, like, envy or hatred, like, those are the results of, like, inequality or, like, broken relationships, like, in society, you know? And so, like, in Olam Haba, like, we won't have those, like, structures that give rise to these issues, you know? And so, like, if you then put that analogy on something like eating or drinking, you know, it's, like, we won't need to eat or drink because, like, we're just eating and drinking God.
I think it's like one interpretation, but so like, they're not all bad things, but like they're just simply things that will be necessary in the model. But I think that's like the perspective.
Alicia, last word.
Yeah, there's so much more. Because then this scene reminds me very much of in Yovel, the same thing happens with the free slaves. Like between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, when they're actually freed, they also, maybe this is the Rambam's language, but they also sit and eat Rosh Hashanah, the Rosh Hashanah, and they're just like chilling out. So just, I mean, there, I know Olam Hazeh's not like Olam Haba, but there is like a, I guess, real world, if that was ever a real world example of like what this is happening in, like, I guess, halachic literature.
Great. Okay. So that's Rav's pearl about this verse, right? Let's see a different approach. Source number three, Ibn Ezra, famous for being a Pashtan, right? Ibn Ezra, one of the sort of main figures in medieval Bible commentary, want to be like, what does the verse really mean, right? Leaving aside sort of Midrashim, and so that here he doesn't fully leave them aside. V'tam v'yochlu v'yishtu. What does it mean when the Torah says that they ate and drank right after seeing God? She'yardu smechem me'ahar. They came down joyously from the mountain. They ate the sacrificial slaughtered meats that their young people had slaughtered. Earlier in the chapter, we were told that there were young people who slaughtered sacrifices there at the mountain. And they drank in joy. And Rabbi Yehuda Levi says, what does it mean that they ate? Ki hutzrechu she'achlu afal pi she'ne'anu meziv ha'shechina. Right, Rabbi Yehuda Levi says, even though it's true, like the Gemara says, that they were getting sustenance from the light of the divine presence, nonetheless, they still were human beings and still needed to eat and drink, right? I won't say more about that yet. These kirs bavur Moshe, and the Torah mentions this because of Moshe, Shaya arbeim yom v'arbeim laila belo achila, kakazu b'parsha acharezos, right? So it says the next section right after this, that Moshe Rabbeinu was on the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights. And even later in the book of Exodus, it says that Moshe was there for 40 days and 40 nights, and he didn't eat bread and didn't drink water that whole time, right? And so we have a model of someone who could go 40 days and 40 nights without eating or drinking. So maybe it is possible when you are sustained by the light of the divine presence to go an incredibly long time without eating and drinking. But says Yehuda Levi, the point of this verse is to say that was true for Moshe Rabbeinu and no one else, right? These folks, even though they did see God, right, they do not get to a point of no longer needing to eat and drink. Everyone, no matter how intensely spiritual, no matter what mystical experience they've just gone through, everyone needs to eat and drink. Take a couple of seconds to think about Ibn Ezra on this, and then we'll take your questions, thoughts, and provocations on Ibn Ezra.
This feels much more like a chat that I can relate to, rather than like, oh, they ate and drank, oh, that means that they were enjoying God's presence. This is like, they ate and drank, and it's like, Ibn Ezra seems very comfortable with the idea that that's a thing that can exist in this narrative.
Great. Eating and drinking is not at odds with being a spiritual person. That's relatable. Beautiful. Sam B.
I think Ibn Ezra is like giving us permission to see ourselves as being at CNET from this as like, look, these people can also eat and drink. Like, we can too have such great spiritual experience.
Great. So you don't think of yourself as out of this parsha, right? You could be there also. Even if you can't imagine yourself just not eating and drinking for some unbelievable amount of time, that's not what's actually called for here. Beautiful.
I don't know how, this is my thought on this, it's the context in which Ibn Ezra was writing, right, was one in which, like, there was, this, like, brings to mind the question you asked before during, like, the binary game, which is, right, it was a context in which there was, like, a lot of food, drink, like, building community, and building across, like, religious communities, especially in Muslim Spain. So I wonder, like, how that ties into, like, his seeming support of, like, the necessity of eating and drinking as, like, part of being necessary. Yeah.
Great. Is there something here not only about food and drink as necessary for my body, but also for my social lubrication, as it were?
Yeah,
beautiful. Beautiful.
Just to highlight one piece of the Ibn Ezra here, even as he embraces the idea that they are eating and drinking, and that seems to accord with our plain sense reading of the verse, he is not willing to go so far as to say that while they were beholding the visage of God, they were eating and drinking. His picture is Yardu Samehi Meha, they descended from the mountain, they had this spiritual, mystical experience, and then they descended from the mountain, and there they ate and drank in a festive celebration. But it wasn't part and parcel of the mystical experience.
Beautiful. Right. Nogob noted how abrupt it is, right? They see God, and then they eat and drink. And Akiva points out, well, Ibn Ezra is adding a step. Yechzu as Elohim, they saw God, v'yardu me'ahar smeichim, and then they go down joyously, and then they eat and drink, right? So introducing a sort of barrier, as it were, temporally, between the vision and the eating and drinking. Beautiful.
Yeah, just to kind of go off that, like it just added a little bit of like nuance, so it's not like mutually exclusive with the one that was before. To be like the metaphor for eating and drinking is like taking in God, experiencing that joy. But then after you experience that joy, you can actually like have food, and that's another way to do it too. So it's like there's kind of two ways to do it.
Beautiful, right? Yehuda Levi, who Ibn Ezra is citing here, he doesn't deny the midrashic read in the Gemara that they're getting sustenance from God's presence. But you still need physical sustenance, right? They're not at odds with each other. They're sort of different things that we both need.
I think that I interpreted it similar to Ibn Ezra in that I imagine that the community was separate from the mystical experience, but he imagines it to be a celebration, whereas I imagined it to be kind of like this has happened and now we're all kind of like eating together in silence, like trying to process what just happened, and like it's awkward and we're scared and like trying to like see how we're going to continue the rest of our lives.
Great. I'm going to pick on you for a little bit, Le'Getol. Where do you see the celebration in Ibn Ezra?
Well, he says that they ate the offerings and came down the mountain joyously, that they ate the offerings. So maybe that was coming down the mountain part, and that they were joyous at coming down the mountain.
Great. So Ibn Ezra and his friend whom he's citing here, Yehuda Levi, they lead into this eating and drinking, is real eating and drinking. But I want to note that it is not, they don't sort of just have it as like, yeah, you have a spiritual experience, then you just go to McDonald's, lahav deal, and go and eat, right? Because what exactly is the eating and drinking that's happening here? Let's start with the drinking, right? According to Rabbi Yehuda Levi, how do you describe the drinking that they're doing? Are they just like, oh my God, I'm so thirsty, I'm going to drink some water? They're not. Vayishtu besimcha, right? It's not the drinking I do when I have like my water bottle that I'm like trying to get through two bottles each day, just like whatever. It's when you drink joyously, what do you call that? When I drink joyously, that's a l'chaim, right? I make a toast. And this drinking is not just drinking to like fill their body, at least the way Ibn Ezra describes it, but it's drinking that's done because they're joyous, right? They're drinking bisimcha, right? And what about the eating that they do? Are they eating hot dogs? They're eating sacrificial meat, right? Meat that's been slaughtered in a religious context. And so even though on the one hand, Ibn Ezra is kind of the opposite of the Gemara in Brachos, saying, well, no, actually, there is real eating and drinking going on here. These things are not fully opposites. And you actually can have a religious experience and a mundane one at the same time. But that mundane experience of eating and drinking for Ibn Ezra is not fully mundane, right? It's got to be an elevated kind of eating that's ritualized in some sense.
I want to suggest that Ibn Ezra supports my point from earlier about like needing sustenance after having such an intense experience. He says that they came down from the mountain joyously, and like, though it's not the most obvious reading, I think that one can suggest that they're relieved and therefore they're eating based on this interpretation. Like, they're happy that they had this experience and they saw God and it could have killed them, but it didn't. And so now they're eating and drinking.
Great. So there's a thankfulness in this meal.
So the joy isn't necessarily that they saw God, but that they survived.
That they survived it. Right? It's a Thanksgiving meal. We just went through this incredible experience that was amazing, but also quite dangerous. And so we eat in gratitude. Excellent. There was another hand that was up. Yeah, Noga.
Yeah, I think that it's interesting also that first there's this discussion that they're eating sacrificial offerings, they're drinking the simcha, which is sort of reads to me as something kind of with intentionality, you know. And then Rabbi Yehuda Levi says, kier, like, because they needed to eat, which is sort of it says to me, like, there's an interesting juxtaposition there. They're not eating just because they're hungry. And they're also not saying, oh, you know, seeing God and being the presence of Shekhinah is enough for us. It's sort of bringing this intentionality of think, okay, maybe they're hungry, maybe they're needing sustenance after such a out-of-this-world experience, and they're doing it with this intentionality now of understanding that there is a new, this is not just eating food, it's not just drinking, this is with a higher purpose, with an intention.
Great. And so whereas before we may have set it up as sort of a binary, that we're now going to destroy that binary, right, of either like eating and drinking is at odds with spirituality, or eating and drinking is not at odds with spirituality, it's part and parcel of it, well, actually, eating and drinking can take on an elevated form, right? You're doing it after this mystical experience, you're doing it because the mystical experience drained you in some sense, and you're not just eating regular old meat, you're not just drinking regular old water, but you're making a l'chaim, and you're actually having sacrificial, religiously framed meat. Let's take a look at one more text on these verses from Exodus. Source number 4, the Ramban, he says, "V'tam v'yochlu v'yishtu," the meaning of this, that they're eating and drinking, "sha'achlu sham ashlamim b'tachtis ahar, lifnei Elohim terem sh'yashuvu o'aleihem." Right? They eat these the sacrificial meats there at the bottom of the mountain, still in God's presence. It's almost the opposite of how Akiva was reading it. I mean, both of them, they're going down the mountain, right? But whereas Akiva was saying, like, that going down the mountain creates distance, Ramban is emphasizing, no, they're still at the mountain. They're eating before getting back to their tents. Ki yashlamim tunin mechitza. Because sacrificial meat requires enclosure, right? When I'm eating a sacrifice, I can't just eat it out on, like, the lawn as a picnic, but rather, right? In the time of the temple, they have to be eaten within certain precincts of the wall. And when the tabernacle was in Shiloh, there was a different measure for where you could eat it. And here it had to be near the altar, still at the bottom, right? But the point is there's still a limit as to where you can eat that food, right? That food, because it's elevated, you can't go back to your camp and eat it there, right? So, what does the Ramban add to our thinking about eating and drinking after a mystical experience?
Just think that there has to be like certain things you do or things you don't do, just to show, like, almost its own sacrifice in itself, that you're abiding by some rules, and that itself shows that it's a special.
Okay, right. One of the ways we mark things as special is by giving limits to those things, right? You wouldn't take the Sefer Torah to the swimming pool with you. There are limits, right? And the eating here is bounded, right? And one of the things we're going to be talking about actually tomorrow is the question of to what extent is food useful for creating boundaries, and how do we make those boundaries, and when do we want to make those boundaries? And so one boundary here is, yeah, like, you can eat and drink after having a mystical experience, but you don't bring it back into your normal life, right? It has to be maintained in a way that feels sort of still more constrained than typical.
Just to sort of highlight the different side of that, like, there's one element of this which is about sort of constraint, but there's another that's about enabling something, which is to say, there's a way in which if you bring this sacrificial meat into your tents, it may not carry the same layers of meaning that you're hoping to sustain by eating it.
Right.
And it's helpful to be in an environment that can sustain that inside the walls of Jerusalem at the bottom of this mountain. Those are spaces and environments that will help you sustain
Beautiful.
The meaning you want to give to this.
Beautiful. Would it be distorting what you're saying, or be accurate what you're saying to say that the boundaries and the constraints actually are what make it meaningful? Beautiful, right? So there are things that we wouldn't do when we're in yeshiva, there are things that we won't do when we're in yeshiva that we might do outside of it, right? And that actually, you know, talking about the cell phones earlier, right? Like, that actually creates the space for having the mystical experience. So now we're going to turn away from the text from Shmos. I'm going to look at another text from the Tosefta. The Tosefta is a text from the same time period as the Mishnah. So we're looking at roughly the year 200, 220 CE. And this is a text that, well, I've loved for a long time. So I'm curious what you will make of it. I'm going to start not being about food, but this intro is going to be important as framing for the part that is about food. Haroa es uchlasim, someone who sees large crowds. Omer baruch hacham arazim, they say this blessing. Blessed is the one who wise in mysteries. Lefiche ein partsufo sehen domin ze laze, because I look at this crowd and I see that no two faces are alike. Ve'ein da'atan domos zo lazo, and no two minds are alike. Ben zomak shera uchlasin bahar abayas, Ben Zoma, this Tannaitic figure, this rabbi from the time period of 200 and earlier, when he would see crowds on the Temple Mount, Omer, Baruch mi shebara es elu l'shamasheni, he would say, blessed is God who created all of these to serve me, which at this point sounds like a pretty arrogant thing to say, but you'll see I don't think it's actually arrogant at all because of what he means by it. What does he mean? Kama yaga adam arishon, velo tam lug ma'achas ad shezara v'charash v'katzar v'amar v'dash v'zara ubara v'tachan v'herkid v'lash v'afar afa v'achar kachakol. Right? The first human being, Adam Arishon, he couldn't have even a gulp of anything until he planted and plowed and reaped and gathered and sorted in one way and sorted in a different way and sorted in a third way and ground and sorted another way, and kneaded and baked, and only then could he eat. Right? There's a whole process to go from the world that God gives us to the food that we actually eat, right? And certainly in the form of bread. But I wake up in the morning and there's bread. I go to the baker and I buy bread, right? There's a whole economy designed to get us to the place where we have our food. And then he goes on, Kama yaga adam rishon velo lavash chaluk ad shegazaz velavan venafas vetzava vetava va'arg v'achar kach lavash. Same thing with clothing, right? Adam, the first human being, had to do all the steps from shearing all the way up to making the garment. V'ani omed b'shachris umotzeh kol elu lefanai. But I wake up in the morning and I've got a shirt to put on. I don't have to make it from scratch. V'chen haya ben zoma omer. And similarly, Ben Zoma would say, O'reach tov ma'o omer. A good guest, what do they say? Zachor balabayis latov. This host should be remembered well. Why? Kama mine yenos hevi lefanenu. How many different kinds of wine they brought before us. Kama mine chasichos hevi lefanenu. How many different kinds of meat they brought before us. Kama mine gluskaos hevi lefanenu. How many fine loaves did they bring before us. Kol sha'asa lo asa ele bishvili. And did it all for me. Right? If I weren't here, they would have brought out one glass of wine. They would have brought out one kind of bread. But because I'm a guest, they brought out the whole thing. Aval oreach ra ma'omer, but a bad guest, what do they say? V'chi ma'achalti lo. There was small, the portions were so small. What did I eat here? Pas achas achalti lo. I just ate one kind of bread. Kos achas shezizi lo. I just drank one glass of wine. Kol ma sha'asa asa letzorech ishto uvanav. And by the way, even that one glass of wine, that one loaf of bread, the host didn't bring it out for me. They were feeding their family and they had some leftover wacky mac, so I got some leftover wacky mac. That's what happens in our house. Right? This is not a good host. Okay, so there's a lot there. What are the things that stand out to you that maybe suggest something different about the relevance of food to our Torah lives and our ethical lives?
I think it's interesting. It's kind of like an economic relationship. Like, you can't just be by yourself and produce. I mean, you can, Adam did, but it's difficult to do it. Instead, it requires kind of a community of people doing different tasks.
Beautiful.
And also, I think it's interesting because, like, food ultimately comes from God. And Adam did have, he could do it. He did it all by himself, and he could. He was given to him, he did it, but it's much more difficult to do it by yourself than when you have a community of
Great. So the first thing Ruth points out is that food puts us into relationship with others, whether we're aware of it or not, right? Ben Zoma wants us to be aware of it. He wants us to realize every time you're eating a Kind bar, there's a whole process that led up to eating that granola bar, right? Starting with some farmer who was planting all the way up to the packaging of that bar that made its way into your home, right? I don't think anyone here is going to be here for week two. During week two, we're going to be talking about the ethics of how our food are made, right? The labor laws that might go into that, and what is our responsibility in those regards. But Ben Zoma is already getting us in that mindset of, I got to realize there's a whole economy that led up to this food that I'm eating. Remind me of the second thing you said.
How, like, even though we, like, God made the food available to us, Adam didn't have the ability to, he was able to eat, but it was even given that the food was there, it's much more difficult to do it by himself than.
Great. And that actually reminds us of something in the other direction, right? I just said that every time you eat, there's a sense in which maybe you should be aware of everything that's gone into that food that you're eating now. and sort of all of the humans who are responsible for getting you that food. But also, it works the other way as well, right? There's a famous problem that we say when we eat bread, you know, Baruch Ata Hashem, blessed is God, Hamosi Lechem in Aretz, who brings forth bread from the earth. But in fact, in the most straightforward sense of the word, God does not bring forward bread from the earth, right? God brings forward wheat from the earth, and we make the bread. But there's a recognition that, you know, what the first half of what Ruth is saying is recognize everyone who's involved in the food you're getting. And the second half is, and recognize that that whole economy also comes from God.
I was also going to say, I was just, like, struck by how, like, Marxist this whole piece was. And find it really interesting now, like, in the way that, like, we get our food from a grocery store that's, like, dim lit, and all these things are, like, packaged in ways that, like, they look, whatever, so different from how you would get them from the earth. And just to think about, like, the means of production, not just, like, the human means, but also... Yeah, other like environmental costs and other impacts that the means of production is producing. And then also thinking, going back to the other text of like, I feel like this whole like juxtaposition between like the Shechina and then also eating and drinking is like, this is our way of being in relation with God is through eating and drinking, through, you know, being in connection with and relation with the goods and the fruits of what God has produced and given us to work with.
Beautiful. Thank you.
This is sort of giving me a different understanding of the usually for how long the world's created for me. Usually we try to check that, like also nothingness and don't turn nothingness. But this is like the world's created for me, and like because of that, let me be grateful for everything. It's just I think it's not the way I usually think about that. Is that usually thought about? That's like that's the thing. It's just through food, but just more generally.
Great. I have loved this text for many years, and even though I've loved it for many years, I always forget that it begins with this very arrogant-sounding line of, you know, God who created all these people to serve me. But as Alicia's saying, but it's not a sort of arrogance of, look, I've got all these people serving me, but rather an appreciation of how lucky I am that I have all these people serving me, right? And presumably he also, I mean, there are different ways to read this, right? There are commentators here who focus on, well, Ben Zoma's a Talmud Chacham, he's a scholar, so he's not engaged in the economy. But I would say, like, that's also part of the economy, right? There are people whose role it is to sort of do this part, that part, and Ben Zoma's appreciating that, and that's really quite valuable.
I was also thinking of the same thing as every person should act as if the world was created for him, that came immediately to mind. And this question of, Benjamin is saying this when he's seeing people at the temple mount. And in relation to our previous questions about what is food good for, or what's the purpose of eating and drinking, seems like if we were to ask that kind of question from this text, it would be that meat and drink so that we could do something like go to the Temple Mount or so that we could do something with that. And I think that's the same sentiment for me as act as if the world was created for you, and that's a great privilege and a great honor, and so what are you going to do with it?
Beautiful. Actually, what you said, Noga, sparked something for me that I hadn't thought about before, which is also, if he's seeing these people at the Temple Mount, then he's not seeing them at their farms doing this work, right? These are people who, yeah, their main role in the economy is to produce some aspect of producing the food, and yet they also have spiritual lives, right? And it's not this hard and fast bifurcation between Ben Zoma, I'm the Talmud Chacham, and I get the food, and they're the plebeians who make the food, but rather, no, like, we're all the Temple Mount, and we all have our roles, and both of us need to be sort of aware of this, of the physicality that makes us able to have a religious life, and both of us need to be able to have a religious life, right? And that's, both those are essential.
Yes, I was trying to figure out, trying to understand what it kind of goes seamlessly from topic to topic and what they all have connected to each other.
Beautiful.
To me, I was thinking, it's like interdependence. Like, this is all about interdependence between people. And I started saying, like, how lucky we are that we see crowds of people, and each one of them is completely different from one another. And how we are not like a dog, like, we're not like him because he has to make everything for himself, starting from scratch. We can rely on people around us, how lucky we are for that. And then it goes into how a guest should act, and the guest has this like rhetorical responsibility to praise his host and like to kind of pay it forward in this way by acknowledging verbally how much his host has provided for him and kind of like
like instead of being like, oh, like the food was bad, like it wasn't enough or something, but like kind of, but like there's an obligation to acknowledge and thank and like kind of praise the name of your host so that people know what they've done.
Beautiful. So Leah Gittles connects these seemingly disparate sections and says they all share this theme of interdependence, right? They're interrelated and they're all about interdependence.
As far as I appreciate it, I think it really helps you, this text really helps you appreciate what happens on Shabbos. All of these actions are, most of the activities are.
All of them, yeah.
Are among the forbidden labors on Shabbat, relating to bread and to clothing production. And so I think I just appreciated the way it just sort of says right to your face what you're supposed to be feeling and thinking when you refrain from those specific activities.
Beautiful, right? Say one more sentence. What am I supposed to be thinking then?
You're supposed to be thinking about I have the opportunity to take a break from all of these things. And, you know, I do 6 days of work, or maybe, you know, especially in the book, other people do 6 days of work. And then I get to sort of live in the world of not having to think about
it. Beautiful. Shabbos is the world in which it's all there already for me, right? Kind of like the Ben Zoma experience, like the experience that many of us have, but this text is saying we shouldn't have during the week, of thinking about everything that was necessary to get to the point of having that food. Maybe on Shabbos, actually, we don't think about that, right? Maybe on Shabbos, it's just like, no, there's actually a time when everything is ready. Beautiful. Let's turn ahead many, many centuries to the Me'a Shiloach, source number 6. This is the Ishbitzer Rebbe. And you'll see this source is not directly on our Tosefta, but he's going to reference the first part in a way that I think is significant. So he begins by quoting a Gemara, Shlosha sha'achlu ka'achas chayvin lezamen, right? When three people eat together, eating in the sense of eating a meal, which means bread, they have to do the zimun, right? The introduction to the benching happens when people eat together. Ha'inyin bezeh, says the Ishbitzer, right? What does it mean? Why do we have a zimun when three or more people eat together? K'di'iza be'gemara, right? Why do we have a zimun? Because it's like what Ben Zoma just said in the Gemara. We saw it from the Tosefta, but it also appears in the Talmud, that no two people are alike, neither mentally nor physically, right? We all look different, and we all think differently. And that's actually the point of the zimun, says the Me'a Shiloach. V'hine, k'sheyochlu shlosha, az roa shlishi, she'ashnei deos nifradim v'hapachim. What happens when I have three people eating that I don't have when I have two people eating? If Miriam and I eat a meal together, well, then I'm just looking at Miriam, and Miriam's just looking at me. But when Miriam and Anna and I eat a meal together, well, now I'm looking I'm looking at Miriam and Anna, and I see God's amazing diversity, that there are two people who are not the same. I see all the ways in which they're different, and I notice that because I'm eating with two people, and that was just one other person. Mizeh makir sheyesh Hashem yisbarach shabara elu hafachim. From this, I realize that there is a God who creates these people with different ways of looking and thinking. And it's Hashem, it's God who brings them together, right? Even though they're separate people, they're eating together, right? And that realization that, wow, on the one hand, God makes people who are totally different from each other, and the other hand, God makes it possible for us to communicate with each other and actually share a meal together. That's what I realize when I eat with two other people, that I couldn't realize if I eat only with one other person. V'chen be'inyin zimun b'shlosha kevan sheyesh shnayim nifradim, l'chen yechol ha'shlishi la'akir ha'kara mifureshes u'lezamen nevarech she'achalnu mishalo. And so therefore, when I'm eating with two other people, that's when I can really actually praise God and say, bless God, because that's the realization of, wow, this is incredible. Only God could have to do, on the one hand, diversity, and at the same time, unity. So I think there is an element that we're not seeing here of, there's something that just happens when lots of people eat together, that there's sort of more kedusha in the room, right? Like there's more awareness of God's presence, and maybe as a version of this, of like, if I can feel God's presence by seeing Anna and Miriam side by side, all the more so by seeing all of you side by side. But I think there's also something here, and the Gemara sometimes talks about this, right? Why are certain things valid as a zimun and other things aren't? And the Gemara sometimes uses the language of ikideos, right? There are minds there, and it means different minds, right? So I think the idea that the Ishbitzer is getting into that really maybe pshat of the Gemara is you have to have difference to have a zimun, right? And it's ironic in a sense, because zimun is all about bringing together, but it's only the bringing together through difference that actually is a meaningful bringing together.
Yeah, this is a little bit like Sotera going against the previous source, in the sense that the previous source is very much about recognizing yourself and like where you fit in
this one is, if you only have one person, you're not going to recognize the diversity of God's creation because I guess you don't have enough self-awareness or something. But so that's something I'm noticing between this and this. I mean, if there's a day out, like maybe with two, you can also do this even, but it's
not. But we don't go that way.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's an interesting.
Yeah, and I'm not sure that's a contradiction necessarily so much as a different angle, right? The Tosefta, which the Ishbitzer is referencing, is focusing on, like, what do I realize when I eat about myself and how grateful I am and where I sit in the larger community. And the Ishbitzer is focusing on, what do I notice when I eat with others, right? What do I notice when I look at other people and see that difference and yet nonetheless coming together? Jake.
There's an old joke about a Talmud lesson where, I won't tell the joke, it's something funny,
I'll be the judge of that.
Two men go down the same chimney, and one of them has to wash, and if one of them comes out clean, and one of them comes out dirty, who washes? And anyone would say, the dirty one, but the clean one washes, because he looks in the face of the other one, and he sees, oh, you are dirty, I must be dirty. And the dirty one looks at the clean one, he says, oh, you're clean, I must be clean. And then he continues, he goes, no, he looks down at his hands, and he discovers he's dirty, so he washes. No. The thing is that if they had a third person there, if they had his own, they wouldn't have to look at their hands, they wouldn't have to look at each other, they could discover each other through the third person, and then they would know.
Great, and what I love about that is I learned something about myself by looking at these two others, right? To go back to the Ishbitzer's example of, you know, we're focused on, I see Anna and Miriam's difference, and I see them coming together to eat, and that makes me realize two amazing things about God. In the same way, I think the Ishbitzer doesn't say this, but I think he means it. I realize about myself that I also am a third mind here, that I'm also different from Anna and Miriam, and nonetheless, I'm eating with them, and I'm sharing something with them, right? And so there's something about looking at the other, and as opposed to in your joke of, like, getting it wrong about yourself, you actually learn something about yourself by looking at the other. Beautiful.
Yeah, it feels like in the Tosefta when, like, they were talking about, you know, like this ability of, like, a diverse and large group of people to sustain themselves collectively, like, when you're eating in a group, like, it's very much like the materialization of that, right? Like, this idea that, like, we all sustain each other, and when you're eating together and you're seeing that you're different, but, like, you're all, like, doing,
beautiful,
like, life-sustaining thing together, like, that's very obvious. And so, like, it's kind of like a very, like, literal moment to, like, understand that.
Right. I am positioned in relation to people not only in terms of what they provide for me in terms of my sustenance and necessity, but also in terms of my community, right? And where I sit, where I literally sit when I'm having a meal.
I don't know, I think it's probably cheating grammatically, but I've just started thinking about the overall title of the week, this idea of, like, you can't live by bread alone. And, like, obviously the shout of the week is that you can't just live with bread and the other things. But also, like, it really seems in this text, all these texts are about how you can't, like, live by bread alone. In terms of, like, there's all of these other steps involved in the production of bread and the eating of bread with other people that somehow frames that experience. Whether that's in other people making the bread, whether that's in you serving the bread to other people and having that guest host relationship, or even just whatever the third one was that I can't remember. But I don't know, I feel like there's something, like, essential about how bread works.
Yeah.
Food works only in food.
It doesn't get to you alone, and you can't really have the full benefit of eating it when you're eating it alone either. Gorgeous.
Something that I'm seeing missing, but maybe is into that a little bit in both Tosefta and this discussion is that there's recognition of what role others are playing in your life, and less explicit enunciation of what role you play in the others. But I think it's a little more hinted here because you look and see there's two other people, then you must also realize, you know, you are also a different person that was created so differently and so in common with these other two people, such that maybe when you're only sitting across one other person, you could adopt the very simple view of, I'm the right kind of person, this other person is an anomaly or is the wrong kind of person or something, that once you have three, you can all, it starts to become harder, and once you're
gorgeous.
And 100 and 1,000, it becomes harder to sort of think that you are different than all these other people.
Beautiful. Love that. Okay. Let's finish off with the Shem Yishmuel. The Shem Yishmuel is the Sagachover Rebbe, so 20th century Poland. I think this is, if I remember correctly, this is, I think, oh, yeah, 1912 is when this was, 1911, I guess, is when this was given. And he says like this, also about our Tosefta. V'hine yadua, dechol chelkei kedusha shemotzi mimakom shayat tvuim sham, tzrichim nikayon. This is coming in the kind of talking about, it's a longer piece about why the Jews are in exile and what we do when we're in exile and how we have to find the sacred things in exile and sort of lift them up to an elevated state. But he says, all those holy things that we find in the place where they're caught up, right? All those things, they require a kind of cleaning, right? Because once you're in a subjected spiritual state, you acquire gunk on you, right? And so those things require a kind of cleaning. Ukmo begashmius, sheyesh lametes malachos, shehem lametes tikunim, ade yelo aliyah be'emtus ha'adam. Right? Just like in the physical world, where there are 39 forbidden labors on Shabbos, and what are the 39 labors that are forbidden on Shabbos in a deep sense, not just in a technical sense? They are the 39 things that are required to take something to an elevated state, right? For human beings to bring something to an elevated state, we have to go through these 39 tasks, right? Ukemashal hapas, shetzarich nikayon me'apsoles al yedei yod alef melachos shebapas, ad yeru'i la'achilas hadam. Like bread, which starts out as basically inedible grain, right? It's not really inedible, but it's basically inedible. And until you plant it and, I guess, plow it first, and plant it and reap it, and all the things we talked about, you don't have edible bread. It's really not delicious bread, right? You have to go through all those processes to take the seeds and turn them into something that's elevated, turn them into bread. Kenu b'chol chelkei kedusha motzi mitachas yad hagalus, tzrichim berer v'nikayon. So too with everything that we bring out of the state of exile and bring into the state of redemption, it requires a process to get it to an elevated state, to a state where it's cleaned of all the things that it's acquired during its journey in the netherworld. V'hine Shabbos, hum ein olam haba. And this goes back to what Max was saying about what does Shabbos do, right? Shabbos is a taste of the world to come. V'al kein, ein ha'avoda b'Shabbos al yedei k'niyah b'shveilus b'Shabbos, ki b'Shabbos ein zman breira u'bor aser b'Shabbos, right? On Shabbos, you're not allowed to choose things. You're not allowed to select things. You're not allowed to take the good from the bad. And so even though during the week, our job is to try to make ourselves and everyone we're with better by doing the work of, well, what part of me is actually the holy part? What part of me is the part that's like just giving into my worst tendencies, right? And doing that work, which can be very painful and very challenging, that's the work we have to do. But on Shabbos, just like we don't select the good grains from the bad grains on Shabbos, so too, we're not into the work selecting the good parts of ourselves out from the bad parts of ourselves. V'chen b'chol lametes melachos, and so too with all 39 labors. U'kmo shebegashmius kenu beruchnius. Just as it is in the physical world, so it is in the spiritual. V'avodas Shabbos hu rak be'ava v'ratzon u'dveikus v'oneg v'yigbal libo b'darchei Hashem. So on Shabbos, how do we worship God? Not the way we worship God during the week, which is by constantly trying to take ourselves from the psoles, the sort of the garbage stuff that the shell of the seeds that no one's going to eat, but we take that seed and we get rid of the shell and we plant it and we do all these things to make it into beautiful, delicious bread. During the week, we do that with ourselves, but on Shabbos, we imagine ourselves already being at that elevated state. And so here, we have food not as a literal thing that brings us into awareness of the part of the economy that we're a part of, but rather food as a metaphor for the work that we're actually trying to do, right? Just like food requires a long process to get from junk to something meaningful, so too our lives are meant to be spent doing the work, going from ourselves as we are to ourselves as we want to be and as God wants us to be.